The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you all for being here. I don't know what's harder to follow, Derek Torres or that compliment from the New York Times about my book, but I'm going to try to see what I can do here to make this an interesting 20 minutes, followed by hopefully some good questions from you all. So the first thing that I discovered when I reported and wrote this book is that there was this a myth perpetrated by the executives of Wall Street firms who are responsible for what happened here, that they basically had nothing to do with it, that this was a so-called tsunami of major proportions that landed on our shores here, and that they were just victims, one firm after another, of the events that occurred starting really in the spring of 2007 and came to a head, first of all, in March of 2008, a year ago, when Bear Stearns failed, and then last September when Lehman Brothers failed, and we're still living through it all, obviously. So the thing that I discovered in writing this book is that these myths that had been perpetrated by, say, Alan Schwartz, who was the CEO of Bear Stearns, who testified in front of the Senate Banking Committee on April 3rd, literally 2 to 3 weeks after his firm had failed, and he said, you know, I'm not sure what I would have done differently. I've racked my brain. I've thought about it long and hard in the 3 weeks after my firm failed, and I just can't think of anything. The funny thing is that Dick Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, said basically the same thing last October when he appeared in front of a House government committee investigating how and why his firm failed. So when I started this project, in March of 2008 and finished it in December of 2008, so 8 months of hard work, what I discovered was that these theories that the CEOs of these firms, who got paid millions of dollars, of course, along the way, that they had no idea how this could have happened and there's nothing they could have done to prevent it, is, of course, no surprise, total hogwash. And so I think what I'll do briefly here today is explain to you why some of what they have been saying makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And the time is long overdue for them to step forward and explain to us what they did and why, and actually admit to their role in this, which I note with great interest that none of them have done so far. And yet many of them still have their jobs as CEOs of these what used to be called Wall Street firms. So there's really sort of three or four main threads of what happened here, and I will briefly go through it so I don't put you all to sleep, which is not my intention in any regard. So the first thing that happened here is the change of Wall Street beginning basically 30 years ago, 40 years ago, from a series of private partnerships to the public corporations that we know today, or that we did know until some of them failed. And what are the implications of that? This happened sort of in the late 60s when Merrill Lynch went from being a corporate structure, a partnership structure, to a corporate structure, and then in 1969 a firm called Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette, DLJ, which many of you may have heard of, actually became the first Wall Street firm to go public. Now, before that, for the first 200 or so years of Wall Street's existence, Wall Street was a series of undercapitalized private partnerships where the partners shared in the profits that they all generated together, and they also shared in the liabilities that befell them. So if one of their partners did something stupid and made a big bet, say invested in mortgage-backed securities, which of course didn't exist really back then, but, you know, something equivalent like that, and the firm lost a lot of money as a result, then the partners as a whole would share in that loss ratably based on the percentage ownership that they had in the company. And that kept, you know, partners in touch with one another. It kept them, you know, from allowing one of their partners to do something stupid if they were aware of it. And it prevented, they hoped, the firm from, you know, dissolving and going out of business. That, which didn't, of course, mean that Wall Street wasn't a very dangerous place. Wall Street has always been a very dangerous place. Firms have always gone in and out of business. And so what's happened here in the last few years is nothing new, unfortunately. What is new here is just the magnitude of the failures, the magnitude of the dollar amounts, the interconnectedness that was allowed to occur. And that really had its origins in these firms going public. And what that ended up doing was changing the compensation system on Wall Street from one where partners shared in the profits and the liabilities to one where the partners, or now they're called managing directors because it wasn't technically a partnership anymore, were encouraged through the compensation system on Wall Street to take bigger and bigger risks for short-term gains, all with the hope of making huge bonuses. And if anything went wrong along the way, well, that would be the fall to the shareholders of the firm to suffer. And in the meantime, me, if I were a trader or a banker, I would have gotten my big bonus, put it in my pocket. No one could take it away from me. If something went wrong in the future as a result of that, well, that's too bad for the shareholders. And that was the system upon which we were operating for the last 40 years. And that is a big reason, one of the main reasons why this happened. Another main reason is, of course, this compensation system, which, as I suggested, encouraged short-term risk-taking at the expense of shareholders and at the expense of the long-term health of these firms. So you had this perverse incentive system to take bigger and bigger and bigger risks. And because of the way Wall Street operated in this environment, the management of Wall Street would always say, no matter what you did in any given year, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. You have to do more of what you did last year and more and more and more. And there's no way for anybody to carburate the behavior. In other words, no one was willing to stand up and say, you know, these high-yield bonds that we're underwriting seem very, very risky to me. So why don't we stop doing that, make less money than our competitors. As a result, my bonus will be smaller. And, yes, we'll take less risk as a firm, but, we'll all be better off. Well, nobody says that. Wall Street is very, very good at financial innovation. In the last 30 years since these firms started going public, we've had a succession of booms and busts. And the reason is because these firms create these products. Basically, Wall Street is one large manufacturing firm. It happens to manufacture financial products that it sells through its sales force around the world and is very, very good at this. So when Mike Milken created high-yield bonds in the mid-'80s, Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, where he worked in Los Angeles, had basically a virtual monopoly for a long time on underwriting these high-yield securities that were used to finance big buyouts. But the rest of Wall Street eventually caught up with what he was doing and that innovation and, you know, pushed the market for these securities more and more, and the bubble around them became bigger and bigger until it exploded in the crash of 1987 that many of you, I'm sure, remember. And then what you may not remember is that there was a credit crisis that followed on from that from around 1989 to 1993. So that's a four-year credit crisis, which was not quite as bad as this one, but everybody thought it was very, very bad at the time. And so by that reckoning, we're about halfway through this current credit crisis. And this boom and bust cycle, this innovation, this incentive system that Wall Street operates under has created these. I mean, I'm sure you all know that we've been living under a regime of boom and bust for the last, 25 years since the credit crisis that resulted after the crash of 1987. We had the internet IPO bubble, when there was a, quote, paradigm shift, and what became important were eyeballs on websites, and profitability became irrelevant. I mean, you can't really forget that. And yet, that was followed by an emerging telecom debt crisis, and now we have a mortgage security crisis, which were securities that Wall Street created in the early 1980s at Salomon Brothers, and the rest of Wall Street took this to heart. It was actually a very interesting innovation, the idea of packaging up home mortgages as assets because people would pay their mortgages, and that interest, those mortgage payments that people would make on a monthly basis would provide cash flow that could service these debt instruments, and these became investments that people all around the world were very interested in, which leads really to the third reason that this crisis happened, and that was because of the decision by after 9/11 by Alan Greenspan to lower interest rates. And he did it very quickly and very rapidly after 9/11 and essentially made the cost of money close to free, not as free as it is today, which is a whole other problem that we may be creating, but relatively free. And that pushed investors around the globe to want higher yield, a higher return on their investments. And so Wall Street, being the innovator, created these mortgage-backed securities that the credit rating agencies had a big hand in rating, AAA. I mean, let's stop for that. Stop on that for a moment, because you know it used to be that only 10 or so companies in the whole country were rated AAA. You know, GE, Johnson & Johnson, among them. And all of a sudden, in this mortgage crisis, the rating agencies were rating nearly everything AAA. Every one of these mortgage-backed securities, you could figure out a way to package them off as AAA securities. And investors around the globe took comfort in that. Well, what they weren't telling you is that the investment banks had paid the rating agencies for that rating, and that it had been a negotiation, and that it was basically a large scam. And these investments were sold off around the globe, which is what made this a worldwide crisis, because the investment banks took these mortgage securities that had been rated AAA, sold them to investors all around the globe that wanted this yield, wanted a higher rate of interest on their investments that they couldn't get because interest rates were too low in this country. And you created this cancer which spread all around the globe. Which leads to the fourth reason why there was this problem, and that is public policy. So you had in the Clinton administration, first and second terms, and in the Bush administration, first and second terms, it became a public good. It was a good thing, the government told us, to own homes. So basically there had been a level of home ownership in this country that was roughly around 62% of families in this country owned homes. But in the Clinton administration, they decided that it would be part of the American dream and a good thing for more people to own homes. Well, I know you know where this is going, of course. The push became for more and more people to own homes, and it became a 16-year push. And they encouraged banks to make loans to people who otherwise couldn't afford them. There was a certain class of renters in this country, people who had been renters for a long time, who should probably have remained renters. But instead, the government was pushing this plan for them to own their homes, pushing banks to make the loans, and naturally, fraud developed in a major way. Where I spent a day in the writing of this book in Baltimore, in the inner city, at a hospice for people who are having problems with their mortgages and paying their mortgages. And all day long, I would sit there and watch these people come into the office and call up and talk about how they couldn't pay their mortgages. And when I looked at the documents that related to the loans that the people had taken out, you could see that the documents themselves had been fraudulently manufactured. There was data on these loan documents that had nothing to do with what these people's ability to pay back. Their income was manufactured, it was lied about, their assets that they had in the bank were lied about. And the problem is, of course, that these people who were manufacturing these mortgages got paid just for the very act of writing the mortgage, of issuing the mortgage. And so when you talk about the blame that goes around here, the people who wrote these mortgages have a tremendous amount of blame. But the sad thing about this really is that these people who had been renters, say in Baltimore, who had gotten a home in the inner city of Baltimore that they really couldn't afford because there was nothing true about their loan application, they signed the loan application. So in effect, they had contributed to some extent to the problem that we have here, because this push for the American dream of home ownership had encouraged them, for whatever reason, and I'm not absolving them of blame, for looking at the loan application and saying, well, none of this information is correct. They didn't say that. They said, well, they must have thought to themselves, none of this information is correct, but I'm going to get this loan, I'm going to get this house, because this is part of what I aspire to as an American. And unfortunately, when you multiply that across the country, the home ownership in this country went from about 62% to 67%, and I don't know whether that's 3 or 4 or 5 million new homes that were sold and loans that were given to people who really shouldn't have gotten these loans in the first place. And when you sort of compound that problem across the country, it's not surprising that in 2006 and 2007, when these mortgages were written, that the people who were supposedly responsible for paying these mortgages back found very quickly that they couldn't do it. The mortgages went into default, and the mortgage-backed securities that had been created by Wall Street and sold all around the world began to lose value. And when that happened, that's why we have a crisis here. And, of course, the unifying effect, the unifying factor in all of this is greed, of course, because at the end, the Wall Street firms were no longer content to buy these mortgages from other people. They decided to vertically integrate their manufacturing facilities. And by the end, each of the major Wall Street firms bought a mortgage broker, bought a company that originated these mortgages and used to package, you know, sell them to the Wall Street firms that would package them up into mortgage-backed securities and sell them all around the world. Now they were vertically integrating. So at the top of the market, you had Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers buying these mortgage origination companies, you know, so that they had a steady supply of these mortgages that they could then package up for a fee and sell around the globe. Well, naturally, this is insane, as we know now. But we also know that by the other examples that I gave, whether it was the high-yield market or the Internet IPO bubble or the emerging telecom bubble, there's no way for Wall Street to stop its behavior. There's no way for Wall Street to say, again, these mortgage-backed securities don't make any sense. The ratings are wrong. The underlying home assumptions about the rates of default on home ownership are wrong, and we're going to stop it. No. Why? Because they are paid. They were paid. The incentive system on Wall Street, since they stopped being partnerships and became corporations that were controlled by stockholders, was to always push for more and more revenue so that their short-term bonuses could be as big as they possibly could be. And again, without anybody willing to say no, stop, that, you know, as Chuck Prince famously said, the CEO of Citigroup, we're going to keep dancing while the music is playing. Well, that's what Wall Street did, and no one was willing to say enough. And so what you have happen is that once again, the bubble inflates and the bubble explodes, and we have the disaster that we're now living through. So when did this become apparent? Well, most people became aware of it. Some people on Wall Street became aware of the problem really in June of 2007, when the two Bear Stearns hedge funds that had been invested heavily in mortgage-backed securities collapsed, and in July of 2007, they were liquidated. But in fact, a number of people were talking about this problem before. As of course, you know, you always find out who these people are after the disaster is happening. Nobody listens to them along the way because they're killjoys. Nobody wants to hear that Paul Volcker in February of 2005 told Stanford University, an audience at Stanford University, that the housing bubble was inflating and was going to become a real problem. No one wanted to hear from Meredith Whitney, the Oppenheimer analyst, who's now since gone out on her own, in the fall of 2005, that the amount of home ownership in this country had risen too fast, from 62% to 67%, and a lot of the people who had been these new homeowners should really have been renters all along and should go back to being renters. And the securities that were created as a result are not going to perform well. Nobody wanted to hear that. And so when they said these things in 2005, nobody hurt them. You know, the proverbial tree falling in the forest, if no one's there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. Well, these people were making these noises, but nobody was hearing them because it was too much fun. Remember, we were all having a good time with Steve Schwartzman, the CEO of Blackstone Group and Philadelphia native, who was celebrating his 60th birthday party on Park Avenue with a $5 million party, and then a few months later became worth about $6 or $7 billion when Blackstone went public. Well, we should have known there was real trouble when Blackstone Group, a private equity firm, is selling stock to the public. I mean, it's just, you know, maybe that's a sign of genius when you can hold two opposing thoughts in your head at the same time, but when a private equity firm decides to go public, you know you're at the top of the market. The interesting thing was the very day, the same day that Blackstone went public, the Bear Stearns hedge funds collapsed. And the amount of the toxic waste in these hedge funds and the value of the mortgage-backed securities related to them were exposed to the world as a major problem. So where was the management of Bear Stearns in all of this? Well, the book is called House of Cards, for the obvious reason that, of course, it was built on a very shaky foundation. But for the double, but there was also this little aspect of a double entendre, which was that the leaders of Bear Stearns, three of the five people on the executive committee, were world-class bridge players. And Jimmy Kane, the CEO of Bear Stearns, had come from Chicago with an aspiration of being a professional bridge player. That's why he moved to New York. And that's how he got into Bear Stearns, was because Ace Greenberg, who had been, you know, the senior partner at the time when Jimmy Kane was trying to get a job there after he met a woman who would become his second wife at a bridge club on the Upper East Side, and she said to him, either get a real job or you get a new girlfriend, and he chose to use the connections that he had made playing professional bridge on the Upper East Side to get interviews at Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Goldman Sachs. And he got a job at Bear Stearns because Ace Greenberg had himself been an aspiring bridge player and had heard about Jimmy Kane's astounding bridge ability and hired him to teach him how to play bridge. And that's what he did. That's what Jimmy Kane did, and that's how he got ahead. He taught Ace Greenberg how to play bridge, and then they played on the same team together, and they won national championships together. And Jimmy Kane knew very little about what Wall Street did. I mean, he was a broker. He had a few clients that were bridge players, and Larry Tisch being notable among them, and one of the wealthiest men on Wall Street and one of the biggest investors on Wall Street. He was a client of Jimmy Kane's because of bridge. And Jimmy Kane had about 10 or 15 clients, and that's about it. But he had incredible bridge-playing skills and political infighting skills. And he worked his way up through Bear Stearns, got rid of any, you know, buddy who threatened him. He also tapped at the firm for a higher position, a guy named Warren Spector, who was himself a high school bridge champion. And he rose up, thanks to Jimmy Kane, to be the head of Bear Stearns' fixed income business, which generated about 90% of the revenues of the firm. And, of course, this is where all of the mortgage-backed securities that Bear Stearns manufactured were housed. And as the firm was beginning to unravel in June and July of 2007, after the hedge funds failed, the day after they had announced that in July of 2007 that the hedge funds were going to be liquidated, both Jimmy Kane and Warren Spector went off to a bridge tournament to play bridge in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, when you're at these bridge tournaments, very intense. Jimmy Kane didn't have a BlackBerry or a cell phone at that time, but even if he did, you couldn't have contacted him during play because it's very strict rules, and when you're playing, it's very intense. And he thought he had had an agreement with Warren Spector that the two of them would not be playing in national bridge tournaments at the same time. Well, when Warren showed up there the day, like Jimmy, the day after the hedge funds blew up, Jimmy Kane, I mean, this is where the personal side of all this comes in. Jimmy Kane was very pissed off to find that Warren Spector was there. And when they would pass each other at the tournament, Warren wouldn't even look at Jimmy. And they played there for about a week to 10 days, each of them, and I think Warren actually did better in the tournament than Jimmy. So Jimmy was pissed about that. He comes back to New York, and this is the beginning of August, and he decides to fire Warren Spector. So because of bridge and being pissed off at the bridge tournament, that Warren actually went to Nashville to play bridge at the same time that Jimmy did. And there were other reasons, too. Their relationship had deteriorated over the years because Jimmy had this thing about anybody, a number two guy who got, you know, too close to him and too powerful, he ended up firing from the firm. Now, you got to remember that at this point, Jimmy is 74 years old. I mean, you know, at some point, the time has come for, and Warren was in his mid-40s, the time had come for a new generation. But what happens so much on Wall Street is that the status quo gets defended far too long. So at firms like Lazard, which I wrote in my first book about, and Bear Stearns, the people who run the firm don't want to give up power. I mean, and it's almost hard to blame them. When you're making $30, $40, $50 million a year, and you don't even know what's going on in your business, and you're playing bridge half the time and golf half the time, who would want to give that up? I don't blame them. So you resort to whatever methods you can to keep those positions. Unfortunately, when you wrap it up into all the other things I was talking about, the fact that you don't understand what's going on in the business and you don't do anything about the risks that are building up in your business become a huge liability for your shareholders. And the five members of the executive committee at Bear Stearns were compensated on what was called a return on equity calculation, which meant that they were encouraged to make as much money as possible using as little equity as possible. And what this led them to do was, in addition to manufacturing all these mortgage-backed securities without stopping, it led them to use those mortgage-backed securities that were building up on their balance sheet as collateral for money that they were getting to the tune of $75 billion a night in what was called the overnight repo market, the overnight lending market. They would use these securities as collateral, and then in the final days in March 2008, when the firm went under, the people who were responsible for providing that $75 billion in overnight financing decided that they didn't want to take the risk of owning those securities, even overnight anymore, because they had lost so much in value. And the fact that Bear Stearns had $18 billion on their balance sheet became irrelevant in the face of the fact that they borrowed $75 billion a night from the overnight financing market. And so that precipitated a huge run on the bank. Now, why did Bear Stearns decide to put its hands in the fate of lenders who provided this cash on an overnight basis, who could decide overnight to stop providing it? Because it was cheaper financing, which meant that their profits were higher, and therefore the return on equity calculation that these five guys got paid on, you know, the last year of the firm's existence, these five guys split $155 million. Not bad. The other part of the equation, the denominator, the equity account, Bear Stearns wanted to keep that as small as possible so the overall fraction would be as high as possible. And they refused to take equity from anybody from the outside, even though plenty of people were asking them to do that. And I will just leave you with one little anecdote to share with you the sort of hubris aspect of this. So I wrote an article for Fortune magazine about Jimmy Cain in the August of 08. It was the first time he had, in my book, is the first time he's spoken about what happened there. We spoke for more than 25 hours, and it's recounted in all its salty terms in the book. But I wrote a little preview of all this in August of 2008 in a Fortune magazine article about Jimmy Cain. And I made the mistake, actually, of going to see him at his New Jersey beachfront home the day the article came out. And I thought that actually the article was very fair. But when I got to his home on the coast of New Jersey, he had very different views about whether the article was fair or not. And one of the things, and I'll just tell you this quickly, one of the things that I had written in this article was how Jimmy had maneuvered his way to the top of Bear Stearns. And having worked on Wall Street for 17 years and having written a book about Lazard, which was another notorious place for political infighting, I thought the use of the word maneuvered was you know, a very nice and gracious way of describing how Jimmy Cain had gotten himself to the top of Wall Street. So this day I go into his house, and I won't bore you with some of the details, but he insisted that I sit down and go through the article with him line by line, and he was not happy about it, I might add, with what I had written. And he got to this business of how I said he had maneuvered his way to the top of Wall Street, to the top of Bear Stearns. He said to me, you know, What is this maneuvered? What is this maneuvered? I didn't maneuver my way to the top of Bear Stearns. I did not maneuver my way. I said, Jimmy, well, what do you mean? I mean, that actually seems like a fair word to describe the way, you know, what has to happen to get to the top of Wall Street. You know, these are not philanthropic organizations. This is, you know, these are tough places. I said, what word would you have preferred that I used? And without missing a beat, he said, ascended. So on that note, a little bit of color. There's a lot more of it in the book, but I hope I gave you some indication of the importance of being honest about what happened here and not hiding behind what lawyers tell you and the myths of what has been created here, because this crisis is the result of a long series of decisions by management, by people just like you and I, except that they get paid a whole lot more than any of us, to make these decisions over a long period of time. And it was not a fluke. It was not happenstance. It was a result of the decisions they made, none of which they have taken the blame for or admitted to doing. So let's try to all keep their feet to the fire on this one, or else we're never going to get beyond this. Or we risk there's a huge risk of course, it happening again. So, thank you. Sure. Yeah, I guess they're going to give you a microphone and... no, Quentin, give it to the nice man in the front row. That was my son. He's a plant. We don't need him yet.
Thank you for coming to Philadelphia and for writing the book in particular. I wonder if in your subsequent research you have any thoughts about the linkage between the former Secretary of the Treasury and Goldman Sachs and the whole AIG bailout and what lessons, if any, we're in danger of finding out.
Now, I don't know this man, so I just want to say that, unlike my son, who is a plant, as a man I don't know. On Tuesday or Wednesday of this past week, I wrote actually a big editorial on the op-ed page of the New York Times, which was quite a thrill because I was between Maureen Dowd and Thomas Friedman about just this question. And you know, because Goldman Sachs had just come out announcing their $1.8 billion in first quarter profits. And basically what I wrote is, you know, do you think there's any linkage, everybody, between the fact that, you know, Bob Rubin had been Secretary of the Treasury under the Clinton administration and the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, and Henry Paulson had been Secretary of Treasury when this all happened and been a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. And oh, by the way, there's lots of Goldman Sachs people in and around, you know, the chief of staff at the White House under the Bush administration was a Goldman Sachs partner. I mean, so I guess what I was trying to do in answer to your question is make sure people understood that there was linkage here between all of this. You know, it quickly, though, can descend into conspiracy theories. And so as soon as you start drawing linkages, then the conspiracy theorists, you know, then people start criticizing you for being a conspiracy theorist. But I don't think it's conspiracy. I think there are genuine linkages and relationships. And to be called out and called a conspiracy theorist as a result is to me a cheap shot. But that's what happens very quickly. But the truth of the matter is that Ed Liddy, who's the CEO of AIG now, had been on the board of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs benefited to the tune of $13 billion as a result of the bailout of AIG. $13 billion that they would not have gotten if AIG had failed. So, you know, The short answer is, and I could go on about this, obviously, but the short answer is there are huge linkages, and it's a very important point, and it gets lost in all of this because Goldman Sachs is an incredible public relations machine and is very good at what they do. And as a result of being good at what they do, they make a lot of money on Wall Street, and they have people who aspire to go on into government. And because they're so good at what they do, they get those jobs. But the linkages are real and need to be explored.
What regulatory suggestions do you have to rein this in?
Well, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, a huge amount of re-regulation. I mean, it's not that the regulation wasn't there. When I was on The Daily Show a couple of weeks ago, Jon Stewart asked me, what's the difference between an investment bank and a Ponzi scheme? Which I loved. But the truth is that what the investment banks were doing was legal. What Bernie Madoff did was illegal, and he pled guilty to it. The problem is that, and that doesn't mean the law is, the legality of it is correct, because a lot of people think that what happened on Wall Street was criminal, although there have only been two indictments so far, and that's of these two guys who ran the Bear Stearns hedge funds. So we're in this middle of this huge re-regulation. But there was plenty of regulation out there already. For instance, in 2004, a lot of people point to this. In June of 2004, the SEC allowed the investment banks to increase the amount of leverage that they could have. And this got back to, you know, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So they increased the amount of leverage that they had, which, you know, Bear Stearns had inter-quarter about 50 times leverage on their balance sheet. So for every $50 of assets they had $1 of equity. You know, at the end of the quarter, it would be 35 to 1. They'd clean it up a little bit. But intra-quarter, it was 50 to 1. Well, as part of the agreement by the SEC to allow the securities firms, Wall Street firms, to increase that leverage, they also said, by the way, we're going to regulate you more. And Wall Street said, okay, well, if that's the price of this, that would be fine. Except the SEC forgot the regulation part. They forgot to go into these firms and monitor what they were doing. The first time, as far as I can tell, that the SEC was in Bear Stearns was the August weekend when they fired Warren Spector. That was in August of 2007. So for the previous 3 years, there'd been no SEC involvement on Wall Street. I mean, so the other thing is that Wall Street is very good at, I mean, you know, the markets are very good at trying to clean up things or trying to improve things. I mean, so now, you know, you have Wall Street firms talking about, you know, greater accountability and pay has come down and more accountability for pay. And, you know, there hasn't been a securitization, you know, deal done in a year or so. So, I mean, Wall Street has changed. I mean, there aren't any Wall Street firms anymore, so to speak. You know, securities firms, the big ones have become bank holding companies, if they even exist anymore. So, regulation will come, and hopefully it's not that the regulation isn't there, it's just that it hasn't been enforced well, and maybe there'll be more money for enforcement. But when you've got guys making $30 million a year going against people in Washington making $50,000 a year, it's not really a even match, and it never has been. Oh, boy. Sorry, I do go on. I write long books, and I talk a lot. Sorry. Sure.
Use the word greed. It's kind of a catch-all. I, having had experience in that market a long time ago as a supplier, I guess the question I have is whether or not we aren't dealing with a whole class of people with ego defects, fundamental ego defects, almost Shakespearean, where there's never enough money.
Yeah. And
I believe there is such a thing as having enough money. Much like casino players keep gambling when the expected value is always negative, and they know that.
I mean, the
issue of greed is sort of a catch-all, but to me, there are ego defects. They are fundamental ego defects, and I don't hear enough of that. These are personality defects. Smart people, doesn't matter how smart they are, they still have these ego defects. What do you think about that?
As I said, I worked on Wall Street for 17 years, and I think I know exactly what you're talking about. I think you're right. I think, you know, it takes a certain type of person to want to go into that environment, highly competitive, and, you know, with a huge amount of remuneration very quickly. Again, that's changing. But I found that when I was on Wall Street that basically ambitious, hardworking people came in on the front, on the bottom of Wall Street, and the kind of person you had to transform yourself into to succeed on Wall Street became incredibly unappealing. I mean, the kind of person who succeeds on Wall Street is not somebody that there's much to admire about. I mean, I hate to make a blanket statement about everyone because there are always exceptions that prove the rule, but I mean, the people I wrote about at Lazard, the people I wrote about at Bear Stearns, the people I interacted with at all the firms all over Wall Street, they have huge egos, it's never enough, it's a way of keeping score, blah, 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 blah. And the way Wall Street rewards, who it rewards, you know, you just find these people get transformed into people who you just wouldn't admire in any way, even though they seem so nice on the outside and so charming and capable of great, you know. I mean, if Steve Rattner were up here, or Felix Rohatyn, or Jimmy Cain, he would amuse you for, you know, for hours, and you would think they're the most charming, interesting people you'd ever met, and yet they are ruthless and they have ice in their veins and will do whatever they have to do to push others out and you know, maintain their position. So you're right. But I'm no psychiatrist, so I don't know for sure. Thank you all. Well, can I take one more? Oh, we gotta go. Sorry. Next time.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.